All right, so I just can't, this thing is going to sleep if I, Yes, that was my system's fault. If I plug it in, it probably will be less in a hurry to sleep. Or maybe I can do something else.
Okay, folks, welcome to the political economy workshop. I have been asked to preside over today's workshop due to the calling of a number of people who were originally going to do it and eventually it came to me. Other engagements, elements, what have you. You know, the coronavirus, but we never. So before we start, let me just get a show of hands. Who is planning to come to the dinner afterwards?
Oh, it's just going to be me.
Okay. Change your mind. No, we're not going to the usual place. Today's presentation is by one of our own, Josh Mason, who was a graduate student here and finished around 2014, and is now on faculty at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, whose economics department has a number of our PhDs. His presentation today is on a title you can read as well as I can, a very timely subject, since the lessons would also apply to dealing with coronavirus as well as global climate change. We'll follow the usual procedure, which is Josh will present in somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 minutes, give or take. During his presentation, questions or clarification are welcome, and then once he's finished, there will be plenty of time for substantive questions. Okay,
John. All right, well, thanks for coming. So I have a couple of caveats to begin with. The first one is this is not a journal article, it's not an academic research paper, it's a paper that was written primarily for an audience of policy people and journalists, but I think there's enough of interest here that it is worth having the discussion here as well. I should also say up front that I'm not an economic historian, I'm a macroeconomist, but I've been working, as many people have been lately, a lot around the Green New Deal and the problem of decarbonization, and this example of the World War II economic mobilization comes up constantly as a model and as a sort of both a specific model of how one can carry out projects like decarbonization and as a evidence that it's feasible to do what people are proposing to do, but I have not seen a really systematic discussion of concretely what are the lessons and particularly what are the macroeconomic lessons of the war mobilization that are relevant for decarbonization. So I thought it'd be useful to write one myself, which I co-authored with Andrew Bossi, who is actually an economic historian. So the goal here is not necessarily to talk about the war mobilization, but to talk about the lessons for today. And it's mainly, there's a little bit of original analysis in here. A lot of it is sort of pieced together and assembled from the existing literature. But I think there are some important lessons, both in terms of the Green New Deal and in terms of macroeconomics. I think World War II experience is quite relevant for a lot of macroeconomic questions. So Those caveats aside, there's a lot of lessons one could draw from the World War II experience for a program of rapid decarbonization of the economy. I want to focus here on three of those lessons. The first lesson is that in this sort of rapid transformation of the economy, the public sector needs to take a central role. I think one of the clear lessons of the World War II mobilization is the larger and more rapid redirection of economic activity, the more direct the role of the state needs to be. And in particular, the state needs to play a central role in bearing risk, I think is one of the clear lessons. Second, I think the World War II experience gives us a very clear lesson in the potential, how elastic output can be in response to demand. It's a real strong, it's strong evidence that we should be skeptical about estimates of potential output as hard limits on demand, that potentially demand can have a much bigger role in boosting output, both employment and productivity, than we usually think. Third, that full employment is a very powerful tool for redistributing income downwards, even in the absence of explicit redistribution policy. The World War II experience, at least in my read, saw really quite little conscious effort to redistribute income, but nonetheless it saw by far the largest compression of income in U.S. history. And I think, obviously, this doesn't mean that we should not be concerned about a just transition when we talk about the transition away from fossil fuels, but I think that we should also not overestimate the power of simply a high-pressure economy produced by a high level of public spending to distribute income downward, and in particular to benefit relatively marginalized groups. So I'm going to go through and talk about each of those points in turn. So the first point is that the war effort involved a very large proportion of not just federal spending, but direct federal ownership of the capital stock, that a very large proportion of the investment in war industries was carried out directly by the federal government, and the federal government was not just using these facilities, but actually owned them. In most of these cases, the plant was operated by private contractors, but owned by the government. In some cases, there's a lot of the shipbuilding. I think about half of the Navy ships were built by federal employees in federal shipyards, and in certain of the other sort of specialized military sectors, there was actually a large direct federal role in production. But mostly what you had is the federal government owning, carrying out the investment directly, owning a large portion of the capital stock, but leasing that or otherwise making it available to private contractors. Yeah, David.
So this does not include the government purchase of machines for privately owned companies.
There was lots of stuff that happened in addition to this. But the point I'm just making here is that the expansion of productive capacity during the war, which was immense. There was in a huge number of sectors of the economy, either you know in areas like steel or machine tools, you had huge expansions of existing sectors in areas like enriched uranium or synthetic rubber. These were industries that didn't exist at all before the war. And in both of those cases, the federal role was not simply, you didn't get private investment that was just carried out in response to federal orders. You didn't just get federal financing. You got direct federal investment and federal ownership of the capital stock, varying across industries. But so there's a couple points about this that I want to come back to. But let me just make a first point, which is this was not the goal of the Roosevelt administration at the start of the war. There was actually a lot of resistance to direct public ownership. The assumption of the administration at the beginning of the period of rearmament was that the capital investment would be carried out primarily by the private sector. And this had actually been the case in World War I. That the great bulk of any new investment that had to be carried out would be carried out by private businesses under their own direction with private financing. So this is Jesse Jones, the chair of the Reconstruction Finance Authority, who is probably, arguably the leading figure in the war mobilization effort, who said, I think the date of this quote is 1940, that private sources will handle the greater part of capital demand for the war program that falls into the category of permanent expansion of plant. The federal spending will only be on sort of short-term temporary stuff. And then, from the business side, there was intense hostility towards the idea that the federal government would be directly involved in investment. I just got some representative quotes up here. The head of the Investment Bankers Association worrying about that those of socialist bent are going to use this new public capital after the war to carry out their socialist program. Some of this sounds sort of contemporary now. The American Bankers Association, the independence of American business depends on having private financing of the war effort. The head of Sun Oil, war production, if we supinely rely on government control and operation, then Hitlerism wins, even though Hitler be defeated. It's equally important, if you're the chair of Sun Oil, to keep private investment as the dominant source of new investment in the economy. That's equally important with defeating Hitler. And, you know, I could fill up many more slides with quotes like this. There was, and I think this is important to remember because I think there's, and I've definitely gotten this pushback on this argument, oh, you know, World War II was different. There was all this patriotism. There was a sense of collective effort mobilizing for the war that, you know, meant that, you know, it was possible to have this much larger public role that you wouldn't have the type of resistance. But it was, there was a lot of resistance, and there was also from the public sector side, there was an assumption that it would not be necessary to have a large-scale public investment program at the start of the war. So you only kind of, the federal government only kind of backed into this situation where they were carrying out the bulk of public investment after trying a number of other approaches. So the first approach was, you know, again, some of this seems sort of contemporary. The first approach was to try to give tax credits by offering accelerated depreciation for war-related investment. If you were investing anything useful for the military, you could write that off after, you know, over 5 years instead of 10 or 20 years. It was 10 years for machinery, 20 years for buildings was the standard. You write it off over 5 years if it's war-related. This had very, very little effect on investment. A fair amount of money actually went out the door, but it seems like, for the most part, it went out for investment that was either going to happen anyway or that was also subsidized by in other ways that actually had an effect. But that was the first approach that at the beginning of the rearmament effort was to try to encourage private investment through tax credits. Then when that was proving ineffective in terms of, and there was a lot of resistance. So I'll come back to this, but there's a lot of resistance by private businesses in investing for the war effort. There was a real uncertainty about how long the war would last and whether there would be any demand for this capacity after the war. So extreme reluctance to invest, even when there were very profitable government contracts available for anybody who had the capacity to meet them. So then they tried this emergency facilities, plant facilities program, which basically said, if you can line up private financing and carry out the investment, the federal government will basically, you can tack on an additional amount to all of your contracts over the next 5 years so that you'll be fully reimbursed for the plant. The federal government will basically fully reimburse you if you make the upfront investment over 60 months. But that, again, was almost completely ineffective. It simply wasn't an inducement to investment. Again, compared with the uncertainty about how long the war would last and what the value of the plant would be afterwards, It didn't induce any investment, and it also still left it on the side of the private companies to find the financing initially, which in some cases was not feasible. If they're large established companies, it's not a problem, but for a lot of them, wasn't. Then the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was, you know, a New Deal program, got involved with direct public lending. So it's sort of like there's a progression, and it's really interesting to read this stuff because there really is a clear progression towards a greater and greater public sector role. So the shift was towards direct lending by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but they had this attitude that they really had to lend strictly on business principles. So that it's kind of funny, but they had these two criteria for lending. One was the company has to demonstrate that they cannot get private financing from a bank. And two, that the loan has to be, you know, has to have good collateral, they have to have assurance of repayment, they have to have, you know, they have to be a creditworthy buyer. But, you know, those are like non-overlapping sets. So this is not, you know, the extreme conservatism of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation meant that they weren't lending, you know, they weren't lending on any significant scale. And even here, you were already getting major political resistance to having them do this at all. So, and again, I think I'll come back to this, but I think there's a big lesson here in terms of what, you know, finance for decarbonization has to look like. So then they adopted these V loans, which were guarantees for private loans, to try to encourage more private lending. But finally, the approach that actually produced the great bulk of the wartime investment was direct investment by the Defense Plant Corporation. The Defense Plant Corporation was spun off from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to actually directly build war plants, acquire the land, carry out the investment itself, and then lease those plants to private operators for the duration of the war. And the typical arrangement was that the contractor, you know, this is the GOCO formula, government-owned contractor operated, the contractor would typically have the option to purchase the plant at the end of the war. So the government essentially had to assume all of the risk associated with the investment before the investment was carried out. You can really see here a sort of incremental steps of the government taking on relatively more of the risk or creating stronger incentives, and eventually has to assume all of the risk. These are almost, you can almost think of them as almost barter arrangements in the sense that the government provides the plant, then the contractor provides, you know, whatever's being produced by the plant. And then this is one other piece here which I just think is interesting, is the machine tool pool. The machine tool pool is basically, you've got these machine tool producers. These are, you know, the tools used to produce other stuff, you know, all the tools that are used in a factory for cutting and shaping metal and so on. Small critical inputs tend to be small specialized producers. The government basically stepped in and said, we're going to provide guaranteed contracts to buy all of this stuff, and then we in turn will resell it to whoever else, you know, any other contractor who needs these tools. So basically, it's a different way of basically taking on all the risk. Because again, these small machine tool producers are very wary of scaling up production on any significant scale, given the time lags and uncertainty, if they don't have 100% ironclad guarantee that these orders are, that they're actually going to have a market for this stuff. In the end, the government actually didn't end up with a big stock pool of machine tools. They actually managed to dispose of most of this stuff. But they have to, again, take on all the risk of whether there's going to be a market for this stuff. So I think there's a couple of lessons here. The first lesson is obviously that the turn towards direct private investment in the war effort was not something that was ideologically preferred by the Roosevelt administration. Some people in the administration, certainly, but the decision makers in the administration did not want to go in this direction. It was really something they were sort of forced into by the sheer inability of private investment to produce anything like the scale or speed of investment in war industries that the goals for military production required. So I think, and in general, this was not because of a lack of financial capacity in the private sector. By 1940, and certainly 41 or 42, the banks were sitting on an enormous amount of liquidity. Their balance sheets were in pristine condition. They were completely rebuilt from the Depression. They had an enormous capacity to lend, but they in general were very reluctant to lend for long-term investment and certainly for long-term investment in war industries. And private sector industry in general, but with some exceptions, you know, where you've got very large incumbent firms where there's a pretty assured post-war market, like in steel, but in other sectors there's not a willingness on the part of private businesses to bear any significant risk associated with investment. And the newer the industry, the more of a technological leader it is, the more this is all true. So again, the industries where the government role is biggest are the ones, again, enriched uranium, synthetic rubber, that didn't exist at all before the war, and then in relatively established ones, the government investment role is smaller. So I think, again, there's a lot of interesting lessons here for thinking about decarbonization, but I think there's a very interesting set of issues here that in macroeconomics, that this is a really nice illustration of. I think, you know, those of us who studied with Jim Crotty or have read Crotty's work are very, you know, or studied Keynes through, you know, here, which is a lot of people who come through UMass, are very familiar with the degree to which uncertainty is this really profound limitation on private investment. And that this is something that the private sector handles very poorly. If you can convince yourself that the future is going to be like the past, you can motivate yourself to carry out long-term investment, even under conditions of uncertainty. But obviously, in 1941, you absolutely could not convince yourself the future is going to look like the past. Or if you thought it was going to look like the past a few years back, you wouldn't want to tie up any of your capital in long-lived investment goods. So there was a lot of uncertainty, both about what economic conditions would look like during the war, what demand for these things would be, and how long the war would last. So there was just an absolute unwillingness on the part of the private sector to hold illiquid, long-lived means of production. And so I think it's a nice case study of this sort of Keynesian or Crottyan perspective on investment. But there's some other more specific issues that come up with the war effort, but that are potentially relevant for today. The fact that in some cases there were major coordination problems where you had to have multiple sectors expanding together. The sheer scale and speed of the expansion that was needed is not something the private markets obviously handle very well. Rapid reallocation, I think, to me, one of the big lessons is that the more rapid the reallocation of resources, the more rapid the redirection of economic activity, the worse the market handles it. Market mechanisms break down when you have to rapidly shift people and resources from one sector to another. You hit bottlenecks, you have to offer extremely high prices or wages. There's a lot of issues, and obviously the coordination issues. And also, of course, evaluating whether a project technically meets the requirement of the war effort is a different problem than evaluating what the financial return of that project is going to be. And businesses are obviously set up to do the latter and not the former. And in some ways, the second task is actually a more challenging one, because you have to know something about the technical conditions of production, but you also have to know a lot about sort of macroeconomic conditions and so on. So asking private sectors to carry out this, you know, large-scale investment on in really new directions on the basis of normal criteria of profitability or expected profitability is not really realistic. So, you know, it's, yeah.
I have a question. Now, I was wondering to which extent the production market concentration at that time influenced the role of the private risk to take the decisions to invest. Because if I remember well, at the very beginning of New Deal era, there was a lot of market concentration from the production side, for instance, in the aluminium industry.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the areas where the federal role was biggest were the ones with the smallest scale producers. The big aluminum and steel producers, some of those basic industries remained, the role of private investment was greater. And I actually think that's another interesting point, along with this claim, which I think, again, a clear effort lesson from the war mobilization, is that when you're talking about new industries, we're talking about rapid technological change, you need a bigger role for the public sector. I think that's the clear pattern, which is sort of goes against some of the conventional wisdom. And I think the same thing goes here. Smaller, more dispersed producers, again, the role of the public sector may have to be larger. For instance, that's why I think the case of the machine tool pool is interesting, because precisely because you had a lot of small, dispersed producers there, they needed this guaranteed order flow in a way that larger, you know, more established companies would not. So again, I think there's just, it's an interesting shift from the way a lot of people think about, you know, where government's role will be larger or smaller. So applying this to the Green New Deal, I think this is if we look at this case, we see that the more rapid the economic transformation you're talking about, the more rapidly you want to shift from one set of activities to another, the more rapidly you want to invest in new industries and disinvest in others, the more direct a role you need for the public sector. The more the public, and there's sort of gradations of directness. You can offer subsidies. That's sort of the least direct. You can try to guarantee or otherwise encourage private lending in certain directions. You can carry out the lending, and then you can actually carry out the investment itself. And you can also just step in and have the government simply replace the market. I don't talk about it in here, but there's obviously for certain key raw materials, steel, aluminum, rubber, they were simply directly allocated by the federal government. The War Planning Board just said, okay, here's the quantity we've got. We're gonna buy all of it and then determine which contractor gets how much on what schedule. So the more rapidly you're talking about transforming the economy, the more you need a direct public role. The market mechanism breaks down well before you've reached any sort of absolute physical limits of production. And this is going to be most true when we're talking about new industries, new technologies, where the financial returns are hardest to evaluate, and the type of risk that the public sector really doesn't like to bear is going to be most salient. And then this last point, which I think is really important, is when we think about the role of the public sector in decarbonization, it's not just about providing the resources. It's not just about spending a certain amount of money. It's specifically about solving coordination problems, where you have to have a lot of sectors that expand together. Obvious cases, electric cars and charging stations. This is the sort of problem the private sector doesn't handle very well, because you can't go forward on one side unless somebody else is going forward on the other side. So solving coordination problems and bearing risk, which I think is a very important thing to think about, because I mentioned the Reconstruction Finance Corporation with these very stringent categories of who can get loans. Unfortunately, it seems to me a lot of the current subsidies and lending, federal lending programs for decarbonization suffer from that same problem, that decision makers are extremely wary of investing in anything or lending to anything that might fail. This is embarrassing and so on. But the one of the biggest comparative advantages the public sector has over the private sector is precisely its ability to tolerate levels of risk or uncertainty that would not be acceptable for the private sector. So unless you're willing to put significant amounts of money and support into projects that may well fail, you're actually not getting the benefit of the public sector, or a big part of what the public sector brings. Okay, second lesson. Capacity is much more responsive to demand than our sort of conventional macroeconomic picture allows. So there was a very interesting debate at the start of the war about whether the ambitious military production targets that the Roosevelt administration had set could actually be met. You know, Roosevelt came out with a whole series of specific targets, so many ships, so many tanks, so many planes, and there was a lot of concern that these, and then depending on this, would obviously be the timeline for an invasion of Europe and so on. There was a question of whether these could actually be met at all or without a major fall in civilian living standards. So this famous feasibility dispute that pitted a lot of the economics profession, Simon Kuznets and others, against the military planners. And it's not a case where you can definitely say, well, the military planners were right and the economists were wrong. But it also is definitely the case that the estimates for the level of output that could be achieved were in retrospect much too conservative. Kuznets basically projected a straight line of growth from recent years and said, you know, in 1941, you know, he looks back, you know, the last few years of growth and says, well, that's the level of output we're going to have, and if you want military production to grow faster than that, it's going to come out of civilian production. And this was a widespread view at the start of the war. There's, if you want to achieve these military, you're going to have a massive fall in civilian living standards. It was almost taken for granted. But the reality is, and I think it's perhaps not as widely appreciated as it should be, that essentially the original military targets were met. Not in every detail, but in some cases that's because military needs were reassessed over the course of the war. The military production targets were basically achieved without any fall in civilian consumption. The war was not a period of austerity for ordinary people. It was not a period of falling living standards. There was really very little crowding out, at least of civilian consumption. Output expanded much more rapidly than essentially anybody at the start of the war anticipated that it could. And this was achieved through a mix of growth of the labor force, but not primarily unemployed people. The numbers of unemployed dropped basically to zero quite early in the war, and employment kept rising steeply after that. And it was achieved through a mix of expansion of the labor force and rapid productivity gains. And the productivity gains were biggest in the industries where military spending was greatest. Yeah, David.
Are you going to tell us the GDP growth rate during that period?
Do you want to?
I think it was about 14.5% a year in real terms from the start after Pearl Harbor through 1944. Faster than China.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the number that I have is about 80% over sort of including the which works out to about the same, including, you know, 1941. So you had these extremely rapid GDP growth, productivity gains, especially in the areas of greatest military demand. You did have some inflation, but it's clear, and again, this was a big dispute early in the war, is inflation a sign of an overheating economy, the way our sort of textbook model today, you've reached the limits of aggregate supply, and so you start to see rising inflation, or does it reflect specific bottlenecks in specific sectors without necessarily meaning that you don't have a lot of spare capacity and unused labor elsewhere in the economy? So, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith, who was the head of the Office of Price Management during the war, or the Office of Price Administration? Was a big proponent of the second view that inflation is not a sign of absolute capacity constraints. In fact, he said, you know, we're not going to reach full employment without a substantial inflationary impulse. So the solution to inflation is not to limit overall demand, and Galbraith and others were very emphatic about this, but to figure out exactly where the shortages are developing and use some mix of direct allocation, rationing, price controls, and hopefully, you know, raising capacity in those sectors. So, again, there's a lot of lessons for the Green New Deal here, but I think there's also a lot of lessons for macroeconomics, because this is, you know, the largest positive demand shock, I think, in history. I think we would agree with that. So it really tells us something about how capitalist economies respond to big increases in demand, or how they can respond, and it seems to me it's quite different from the textbook story on a couple of dimensions. So now here's a figure showing, this is, you know, this is all kind of bricolage. So this is from Rockoff, although I've arranged it a little differently. You, Rockoff. So you can see that essentially there's a little bit, during the war, the blue line is civilian consumption. There's a little bit, and this is, you know, it should be real terms. Obviously, correcting for inflation is even more problematic during the war than in other settings, but, you know, there's a big debate, but anyway, this is Hugh Rockoff's attempt to do that. So there's a little bit of leveling off during the middle of the war, but there's no decline in civilian consumption. Per capita civilian consumption is higher you know, throughout the 1941 to 45 period than it is at any preceding period. There's no absolute fall in civilian consumption. There's a little bit of leveling off of the growth rate, but even the modest leveling off of the growth rates is trivial compared with the expansion of military of production. So essentially, this huge expansion of military production, this extremely rapid growth during the war, you know, about an 80% rise in real GDP over this period is essentially all additional to the level of output. And you can see there is some squeezing of civilian investment here, but even that's a bit misleading because a fair amount of this military spending actually was producing, you know, capacity. It was producing capital goods that were then transferred to the private sector after the war. So, in a sense, some of this green stuff retroactively became civilian investment. So, and this picture is consistent if you look at specific categories of consumption during the war. If you ask, you know, how many calories were people getting a day? How often did people buy a new pair of shoes? How much ice cream were people eating? You know, all these things actually went up during the war in the aggregate. And if you consider, as we'll get to the next section, that the income distribution was greatly compressed, for the large majority of Americans, this would have been a period of rising living standards. Obviously, there were no new cars produced during the war, relatively little new housing produced during the war, but in the aggregate, living standards rose quite a lot during the war. And I think this is quite informative if we're, again, because this is the biggest demand shock in history, so it should be the most informative about what are the general possibilities for a large increase in spending calling forth new supply. So how did this happen? Well, it was about... let me see. Maybe I should flip back to this, go on to this slide, and then come back. It was about of the 80 points of growth, you can divide that up into roughly half increased labor supply and half increased labor productivity. So the labor supply is about half rising employment, about half longer hours. Longer hours maybe we don't see necessarily as a real gain. On the other hand, they were very desired. Overtime was highly valued by workers during the war, since there were limits on wage increases. So maybe you strike that off as a genuine, or maybe, you know, we don't necessarily want people to be working longer hours today. But you've still got 20 points of increased employment and 40 points of increased labor productivity. Rockoff again breaks this down. I wouldn't put too much into this, especially total factor productivity is a very dubious concept, but let's at least say 10 points are sort of just sectoral, people moving out of agriculture in particular, where labor productivity is very low, and into other sectors. And then 30 points are within sectors, which he thinks is 10 points from the capital stock and 20 points from just general technological improvement. I wouldn't make very much of, but the general point that it's about half increased employment, about half increased labor productivity, I think we can trust. So the increased employment is interesting because I think we have a lot of people have a perception that this is all just the fact that there was a huge slack in the labor market before the war. You know, it was the Depression, and so you could draw that down, or it was all, you know, unemployed women. So you can see about it's not a completely comprehensive accounting, but we have manufacturing, war and non-war, government, civilian, military. So the wartime uses of labor, the new labor that was called forth by the war effort, is about 14 million people, which is also just about exactly the increase in the available non-agricultural labor force during this period. David?
Does that include the armed forces?
Well, yeah, military there, 9.8 million.
Well, big civilian, that
Yes. Yes, that yes. In fact, the majority of that is the armed forces. It's 10 million out of that 14 million is the armed forces. So you have a big right. You have a big increase in military employment. 10 million people in the military, but then you also have another 4 million. You have the civilian government sector gets substantially bigger during the war, and there's a big increase in manufacturing employment at home as well. A lot of which, most of which, is oriented towards the war, but some of which is not. So a big increase, but the where those workers come from, you know, the unemployed, which includes people in WPA, Civilian Conservation Corps, all those jobs programs are counted as unemployed. We can debate another time whether that's appropriate accounting, but anyway, the ranks of the unemployed as of 1941, including the people in those programs, provide, you know, it's about five, so it's about a third of the additional employment comes out of people who were unemployed or on government employment programs at the start of the war. Then the rest is about, it's a bit of the remainder, about half is women, so the role, you know, of the war in drawing women into the labor force is significant. But, and then a small group is people coming out of agriculture. But a big chunk of it is men who just weren't in the labor force in 1941, who entered the labor force during the course of the war. So there was a big reserve of labor beyond the, what we counted as what was considered as unemployed, and beyond women that could be mobilized by the fact that you had these super hot labor markets during the war. You had basically jobs for anybody who wanted one, and that brought a lot of people to the labor market. Yeah.
Can you give us a little more detail on older, were they in informal employment, or what do we know about
them? I haven't tried to do that. That's a good question, which I will make a note of to add to this. No, I haven't tried to answer that question. Easy question to answer, though. The key point I just wanted is there's a lot of labor that's not in the obvious. Boxes of available labor supply. There's a big increase in employment. So, let's see. We did this. And again, this is part of why you don't see a fall in consumption living in civilian living standards, because there's no reallocation of labor from civilian production into wartime production. The military needs of the economy, military labor needs of the economy are more than met by the increase in the labor force during these years, it's a huge increase, obviously proportionally, if you look at the numbers. It's an increase of about what would that be, about a third in the size of the labor force in that very short period. Okay, inflation, the point here is this. There's a lot of measures of inflation, a lot of controversy about how to measure inflation during the war. But all of these measures show something consistently, which is a big drop in inflation between 1942 and 1944. And that's important because there's no slackening of demand. There's no rise in unemployment in that period. There's no effort to deal with the high inflation of 1942 by trying to ramp back federal spending or otherwise, you know, take the sort of approach to inflation that we assume is the correct one today. It's all dealt with through price controls. Essentially, the OPA learns how to do their job more effectively and manages to make price controls stick and figure out. And the result of that is that there's a big fall in inflation. And you can't really see it here, but the notion that some people have that this is going to be a sort of stored up inflation and a huge spike in inflation after the war isn't really borne out. Depending which measure you use, there's some, but there's no suggestion that we had, you know, an extra 10 or 20 points of inflation kind of, lined up that would come out as soon as the war ended. Actually, that post-war inflation dropped off pretty quickly. This really supports the idea that inflation, at least in this context, is much more of an issue of specific bottlenecks in the economy and not about overall demand simply being out of line with potential supply. And I should add, you know, the rationing, which was a feature of the wartime experience, is just the flip side of the price controls. If you have rapidly rising incomes, people are going to try to spend more money. If you then control prices, then people will have an excess of money and you'll have to allocate goods in some other way. And the other side of that is obviously wartime programs to encourage saving, which were quite effective. So people talk about rationing and they assume this means a fall in living standards, that you have to ration goods because there isn't enough. But actually rationing was just a sign of a rapid increase in incomes that was not, they didn't want to allow to be spent on fully spent. And also, obviously, certain necessities had to be, you know, you want to make sure that there's not shortages faced by anybody. Okay, so the broader picture here, then, is that supply constraints turned out to be much more elastic than anyone expected at the beginning of the war. The Galbraithian perspective that inflation reflected specific bottlenecks and shortages rather than overall capacity constraints seemed to have been borne out. And another aspect of that is inflation of that nature is sort of inherently time limited. It's not going to be saved up. It's not just an excess of income relative to the capacity of the economy to produce stuff. After the war, to some extent, the bottlenecks go away because the government is no longer trying to purchase an enormous amount of a relatively small set of goods. Some of them go away because capacity catches up. And then some of it also, there's a, just sort of a permanent change in saving behavior. People didn't want to spend down their war bonds at the end of the war. They thought, I'm going to use these to start a business or buy a house or go to college. So large new entrants to the labor force who aren't drawn from the obvious reserves of unemployed labor. And then this last point, which I don't have a slide. I should have a slide. Well, I don't have a slide in this set of slides. It'll be there's a picture in the paper. The labor productivity gains were highest in the industries where there was the most wartime production. For example, aircraft, where production increased by a factor of 7 over this 3-year period. So this, you might say, is sort of obvious, but actually, if you think about conventional economics, it's not obvious. We would expect a big demand shock to lead to rising prices, falling productivity. Things are produced under conditions of declining returns to scale. If you try to buy a whole lot of something, it's going to get progressively more difficult to produce. This is what I think we mostly all teach our students in introductory classes. This is supply curve slope upward, you know. So this is looks like a very strong form of Verdorin's law, because obviously it's not the case that aircraft production just happened to experience a technological breakthrough at the exact moment that the government was buying lots of those types of planes. Obviously, it's a clear sign of learning by doing. The fact that you had this huge increase in spending in this particular sector generated very rapid productivity gains in that sector. So I think this actually has really pretty far-reaching implications about, you know, how we think about supply and economics in general. That there's strong reasons to think that this model of, yeah.
But wouldn't there also be expenditure on research and development, not just like increasing demand for?
Well, there was definitely some of that, but again, that's sort of part and part. I mean, if your intuition is what happens when there's a lot more spending on something. Presumably, the general case would be that huge is going to include that. Also, a lot of this does seem to have really been just, it wasn't systematic research and development. It was just that people learned to improve their techniques very rapidly. You know, I when I was working on this, I read this great book about the Willow Run aircraft factory in Michigan, which you know really goes into the details of this. And it wasn't a lot of conscious R&D. It was a lot of really on the ground experience with how to organize this activity more efficiently. Yeah.
Was Willow Run was Ford,
yeah,
and it was government. Could you describe it in the context of, government owned this?
Yeah, it was government owned, contractor operated, like most of the aircraft industry. You know, even big companies like Ford. And I mean, it's a fascinating story because this was a case. There was in all this stuff. You know, the New Deal people within the administration really were looking for an. And maybe this is the negative story for the Green New Deal, because a lot of the people in the administration, the sort of leftists and New Deal people, really saw an opportunity to kind of do some social engineering around all this spending. So the original idea with Willow Run is you're going to build this thing out in a, you know, completely undeveloped area, well outside, and then you're going to build up like a whole set of model housing for the workers around it. You're going to have this plan sort of be community for that's going to be this sort of model where everybody's kind of living side by side and have all these wonderful public facilities. And there was just complete backlash against it, in part because they insisted that it not be segregated, and there were significant black workers at the plant, and everybody was going to live together. And, you know, local real estate interests really hated the idea of the government getting in, because they at least hadn't had government on their turf. And then the question of having black workers living, so ended up not. It ended up people just commuting. So, but yeah, it was just an example of the, yeah. So what are our lessons here? Again, if we think about the Green New Deal, we should not take current estimates of potential output too religiously. We should believe, certainly if we're looking at the World War II example, that even a massive program of spending on decarbonization would not necessarily crowd out other forms of spending. And I think this is so critical, because so much of the discourse around climate change, both from the orthodoxy and from the left, is this notion, is sort of versions of climate austerity, that it's a question of how much do we give up now to preserve a habitable planet. The whole Nordhaus thing, you know, that Bob and I were just talking about a little while ago, you know, this whole thing is about trade-offs. It's about, well, we just have to lower consumption so much today, and then we have to figure out with the discount rate what that optimal trade-off is. I think, you know, certainly based on this experience, but I would say there's plenty of other evidence that points in the same direction, we should not assume there is any such trade-off, that if anything, the stimulus to demand from a major program of decarbonization is likely to raise living standards for people not, you know, 30 years from now, but also right now. And that means, obviously, we really shouldn't do our analysis on the basis, okay, we've got a fixed quantity of output, how much are we going to allocate to climate change? Labor force, similarly, we can believe, I think we again have a lot of independent reasons to think this, but World War II is another strong piece of evidence for it. Labor force growth is quite responsive to demand conditions. Treating the labor force as an exogenous variable or constraint is just not, it doesn't reflect the historical experience. Rising inflation, we shouldn't necessarily think of that as meaning the absolute capacity constraints have been reached. We should get out of this box that the appropriate solution to inflation is simply to limit aggregate spending in the economy. And we should anticipate there'll be some form of increasing returns when we invest in climate change technology. There's no reason we shouldn't see the same sorts of productivity gains that wartime industries like aircraft enjoyed, which implies obviously lower costs than a sort of static estimate. It also becomes an important argument for a public investment-led approach, because when you're dealing with increasing returns, you've got an industry potentially that's not very cost competitive at all at the beginning, that would take a very large subsidy initially to get off the ground. And if you try to get that, give them that relative cost advantage through something like a carbon tax or a carbon permit, that's going to have to be set at such an extremely high level, it's going to impose major costs and disruptions on everybody else, which, as we've known, just politically is not viable and is not necessary. Whereas a targeted public investment or public financing or subsidy, as the case may be, gets you over that hump, gets you up that curve to the point where you can then become competitive and either need a smaller subsidy or no subsidy at all. So I think if you believe in increasing returns, you're much more likely to want to see some type of direct public investment rather than a carbon price approach, because carbon price is very, very poorly suited to moving new technologies down the cost curve. Now, applying this to today, I think we have strong reasons for thinking that we are still today in a situation of substantial excess capacity. So this is just the official BEA measure of the output gap, you know, over the past, whatever that would be, 25 years or 30 years. A lot of red on there. Even by the official measure, the economy has been well below capacity for the great bulk of that time, particularly since 1980, and only relatively short periods where it's been above it. So on average, even if we take the official measures of potential completely without question, on average, you know, there's at least a couple points of slack capacity in the U.S. economy. And of course, we might anticipate that we're going to start seeing some red again in the near future. So if we're looking forward for a program of decarbonization, we have to consider not just the current level of output, but where we anticipate it's going to be over the coming years. So basically, we shouldn't assume that we're normally at full employment, which again is an unfortunate assumption that a lot of these a lot of economic analysis of climate change starts from. And then there's good reason to think that the BEA measure is substantially understating the level of capacity. Certainly, if we were going to take the approach of looking at the long-run growth rate of real per capita GDP, we would think there's maybe 12% output gap today. You know, during the whole post-war period, it's really kind of remarkable how close to a constant growth rate real per capita GDP is. Every, you know, downward deviation recession is followed by a period of catch-up growth, so you get back to that same line. And only since 2008 has that failed to be the case. So, you know, there's a lot of dispute about this, and obviously we wouldn't want to take it completely literally, but certainly there's a very credible argument that this is at least another important indicator of slack in the economy, and on this basis there's a huge amount of slack. You know, if we look at the labor force, again, you know, focusing just on 25 to 54 prime age workers, you know, we're a point below where we were before the last recession, and 2 points below where we were in the late 1990s. So again, at least some evidence on its face that suggests there's substantial excess labor available beyond what the official unemployment rate would tell you. And you could make this same point by comparing the U.S. to other advanced countries, which in the often have early retirement ages, but in the prime age workers, especially prime age men, typically have higher labor force participation. Actually, most of women do. Labor force participation. I also think, in terms of this here, it's quite a strong bit of evidence that, that there is an important role of labor demand in setting the size of the labor force growth, because since we've had some recovery in the labor market, unemployment has fallen a bit, wages are down a bit, we've actually seen substantial increase in labor force participation, which, you know, if you remember these debates, people were predicting that was impossible. Okay, so let's move on. I wasn't worried I wouldn't have enough material to fill up the time, but now I'm having the opposite worry. Okay, so the last lesson is that full employment, like we had in World War II, is an extremely powerful tool for redistribution of incomes, probably the most powerful tool there is. The U.S. had by far the greatest compression of incomes during this period. This is true for pretty much every other rich country in the world, whether they were belligerent or not. Obviously we can treat certain cases that were completely demolished during the war as special cases. But in general, in the U.S. and elsewhere, the largest compression of incomes in history, the biggest gains were to specific groups of workers who were the most marginalized at the start of the war, such as African Americans and agricultural workers. And essentially all of this happened sort of automatically through the labor market. There was not an explicit policy of redistribution as part of the war effort. So, okay, basic facts. In this quite short period of time, 1940-1944, the top 1% share falls from 15.7% to 10.5%. That's a very large fall in a very short amount of time. There's really no other period with anything like that. Obviously, if you look at the top 10% share, it's similar, 45% to a little over 30% in about the same time period. So extremely, the data is from Piketty's Top Incomes World, you know, whatever that is, Top Incomes database. So an extremely, extremely sharp compression of incomes with the share at the top falling very steeply. Also a big compression of incomes across industries. This is just a bunch of different industries. The scale circles are scaled to the employment at the start of the war, and the x-axis is the hourly wage in dollars in 1940, and then the y-axis is the change from 1940-1946. And you can see this is practically a straight diagonal line. In other words, the lower were wages at the beginning of the war, the bigger the increase during the war. And what's especially striking about this is that, in general, the war industries were not low-wage industries at the start of the war. The industries that were getting the direct boost from wartime demand were relatively high-wage industries. By far, the lowest-wage industry at the start of the war was agriculture, and it's actually not on here because I wanted to do hourly wages, and they only have weekly wages for agriculture. But if you were to do this with weekly wages, I didn't want to use weekly wages because that mixes up pay rates, and as we saw, there was a big increase in working hours, so it doesn't seem like as clean a comparison, but then you leave out agriculture. But if you look at weekly wages, by far the biggest increase in agriculture, which is by far the lowest wage. If you look at, let's see, I think the next slide I have some numbers. So war manufacturing industries' wages rose by about 70%, $29 a week. This is weekly wages, so It's again got that hours issue. I should change that. But the pattern is still the same. Textiles, apparel, lower wage industry, incomes double. Oh, I did it this way because I wanted to have agriculture in the comparison. Agriculture, weekly wages nearly triple. So the biggest, and again, the stuff that's up there in the upper left corner is textiles, food processing, tobacco, leather. Retail, those are the low-wage sectors where the wage gains were biggest. The manufacturing sectors that saw the most direct impact from the war effort still saw relatively modest wage gains. And again, this is not a matter of policy. In fact, the main wage policy during the war was just they took a base year, and then they said wages cannot rise more than 15% above this base. So the actual wartime wages policy had the effect of preserving the existing distribution of wages. But so this compression happened despite that. So uh, so it really is just a matter of extremely strong demand in labor markets gives workers more bargaining power, and that benefits most the people who had the least bargaining power to begin with. It also tells you something about, you know, this is not a graph of relative productivity rates. This is wages. The workers are not getting huge productivity. If any of these productivity gains are happening in the war industries, but the wage gains are happening in the other ones, because that's the workers who have the least bargaining power are the ones who benefit the most from the extremely strong labor market of the war. And that's where you see the big increase in wages. Obviously, unionization rates went up a lot. It's not clear that unionization had that big of an impact on wages during the war. It was very important in preserving the gains after the war. This is really just about people having the option of quitting their job and going somewhere else, and employers responding to that. So to me, this is it's really striking because, you know, it's really striking, and I don't want to dismiss people who say we need a just transition, we need to think about how do we have targeted employment policies, but I really think the war experience tells us that if you run the economy hot enough, if you get unemployment rate down to 0.6%, which is I think where it got to, you know, official unemployment and no disguised unemployment, that has an incredible egalitarian impact on the distribution of wages and income just by itself without doing anything targeted, because the people who are at the back of the line for hiring are the ones who benefit the most when everybody gets a good job and when employers really have to compete. The people who have the least bargaining power are the ones that help the most. And we can also see this if we look at black wages. So this shows the male blacker, male men 25 to 54, median black wages as a percent of median white earnings. This is between 1940 and 2010. What you can see here, by far the biggest closing of this gap happens during the 40s. Unfortunately, we can't get this one with any more. You know, you didn't have the ACS or the CPS back then. We've just got the decennial census. So we got to go by 10 years. But this, I feel comfortable saying this is the war. And it's by far the biggest, you know, you go from 35% of median white wages to over 50% of median white wages, which is actually a smaller gap than we have today between median black and white wages. There's a little bit of improvement in the 60s, but, you know, yeah.
And probably most of it came in the first half of the 40s.
Right, but again,
even steeper.
Yes, that's, I'm sure that's true. I don't know if there's any way of doing that. There probably is. My and my co-authors' ability to identify appropriate data. It seems, I mean, I shouldn't be so humble. I looked at a lot of papers. Everybody seems to use the decennial census for this. Maybe you can do better. But in any case, we're going by decades, and this is, you know, this is by far the biggest closing of that gap, and in fact, you know, the rest of the period since 1950, the overall gap has basically gone up and down and not really closed at all since then. And again, there was no significant policy to close the racial wage gap or to improve or to there were some very feeble efforts to discourage or on paper forbid racial discrimination during the war. But every account that I've read says this was not effectively enforced. It's literally the case that there was not a single employer who was actually penalized under the anti-discrimination statutes during the war. The priority was 100% on maintaining production, and there was no effort to give any teeth to the efforts to combat discrimination in hiring. And in fact, unfortunately, as we know, a lot of the established labor unions were actually very hostile to black workers coming into white occupation, and yet nonetheless they did, again, simply because of the absolute shortage of labor that forced employers to take people who they never would have considered under other circumstances. Now, the interesting thing about this is if we look at median wages, the entire thing here is about the flattening of the overall wage distribution. So here, I took this just to illustrate the point from another paper. There's basically two ways you can imagine the black and white median wage getting closer. One is that the whole distribution just compresses. So this is what, you know, we call distributional convergence. Obviously, you're still, if the median black worker is at the 30th percentile at first, and then they're at the 30th percentile afterwards, but the overall distribution is flatter, those two medians are going to be closer. So that's distributional convergence. The other possibility is that the overall distribution stays the same, but black workers move up in it. So that's what we call positional convergence. The wartime convergence was 100% distributional. In other words, it was all about, for the median, it's not true at the top end. The high end, like if you look, compare 90th percentile, there's both distributional and positional convergence. In other words, there were black workers moving into skilled occupations that had been closed off to them before. So at the top end of the distribution, there is distributional convergence. But for the median black worker, the entire gains during the war come from simply the flattening of the entire curve. And you can see that this is vastly bigger than any of the changes since then. In fact, I think this is, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's an interesting, it would tie into a lot of political debates, but what you can see is, you know, the closing of the gap between median black and white wages is really dominated by the changes in the overall distribution. The two periods, well, you know, in this period you've got the periods where you've got an actual convergence, especially the 40s, but also the 1960s, are because the overall curve is flattening. In the 60s, there's also some positional convergence. But since then, in, I don't know, we might call a lot of the 70s, 80s, 90s, into the neoliberal period, there's been continuous positional convergence. In other words, black and white workers have moved closer to each other within the distribution, but that has been overwhelmed by the fact that the whole distribution is getting bigger, so that the median black and white workers are moving further apart. To me, there's a story that goes beyond World War II in this. But the key point for World War II is that the super tight labor markets of the world and the flattening of the overall wage distribution disproportionately benefited black workers, and in fact led to the only convergence. You know, at least I don't. You know, maybe we can. It would be tricky to talk about it, but since certainly the only convergence from that period till today by far the largest convergence since that period till today between median black and white wages. So again, it doesn't mean that if we're talking about a Green New Deal, we should not consider these things, but it also does mean that the simply producing a really tight labor market by spending enough money on anything really has a tremendous power to flatten these gaps. And I think, you know, I think you could find the same story. In fact, I'm pretty confident you could if you looked at other countries as well. And then, you know, the tax, this is not the best figure. I'm going to do a better one. But the tax system was not particularly progressive during the war. The tax system was mainly oriented towards raising revenue. Although there's a big increase in tax rates at the top rate, you know, goes from 15.7% to 38.5%. But there's a big increase in the taxes facing people at the bottom of the income distribution. I think in 1942 is when everybody starts paying income tax, before then, you know, most of the bottom distribution didn't pay any income tax at all. So the biggest increases, at least, you know, proportionately, most of the revenue came from lower down the income scale. And there was really no effort to tax capital gains income at all. So the tax system actually did very little to redistribute income in this period. It was really all of that compression, all that fall in the top share is just all about rapidly rising wages at the bottom. Yeah, Carol.
There is more of a connection there in the sense that it was the widening of the tax base, the fact that many more people were being taxed and their revenues could be raised that allowed all of that public spending. So people talk about how World War II really changed the whole structure of fiscal structure in the United States, because that widening tax base really stuck afterwards. So I think the question for the New Deal is there's a similar need to come up with new revenue sources, whether that's more progressive tax at the top or internet, you know, new sources of taxation. But that was a big part of the story of why the demand could rise because of the, you know, extra public investment.
Yeah, I wouldn't dispute that at all. My point is just that the tax system itself did not do much direct redistribution. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking for progressive taxes today, but again, if we're looking for the World War II lesson, the World War II lesson is that if you have strong enough, if you have tight enough labor markets, you don't need that. So, lessons, okay, so just transition is important, but don't underestimate the effects of strong demand. Sustained superfull employment is more powerful for income compression than any sort of direct policy. Strong labor markets benefit even those who aren't directly employed by the public program. So again, and I do think this is a problem with some of the way this stuff gets discussed, that the assumption is that only the people who are employed through some type of Green New Deal program are going to reap the benefits and we have to really worry about who they are. But if you employ enough people, that pulls up wages for everybody else. Full employment is most important for the most disadvantaged workers. I really think this is important. And again, it's not just a lesson about the Green New Deal. I think it's not just a lesson about the World War II. I think it's a lesson that we can take from a lot of places. But I do think there's an assumption sometimes when you talk about full employment, oh, but that leaves people behind. It leaves behind the less skilled. It leaves behind, you know, people of color. But no, actually, those are the groups of people who benefit the most from full employment. And obviously, if we care about income distribution, that becomes another argument for a massive public spending program. And then just to make the point that this dynamic still exists today, you know, at least I would argue it's pretty clear-cut in recent years. During the depths of the recession, when unemployment rate was very high and wage growth was low for everybody, it was lowest for people at the bottom. And incidentally, if I drew this for high school education for the red line instead of the lowest quartile of wage workers, I would get basically the same picture. Then, as we've had a relatively tight labor market, in recent years, the biggest gains have been at the bottom. So I think there's no reason to think that this same dynamic doesn't apply today. And this is my final lessons, but I think I'll stop here and take questions. I don't know many names in here, but sure.
Thank you. That's a fascinating presentation, and it's a great thing that a lot of things to learn. But I had a concern, and the period which you spoke about, especially 1940 to 1947, it experienced a move from farm workers to the non-farming workers, and also a decline in inflation. Now, one of the reasons which has been told in the literature by the economists from the South, like Prebisch, Singer, and even Prebisch in Berkeley, was the relationship which the U.S. had at that time with the outside world, especially the agricultural economists. And in fact, Prebisch, in his report in the United Nations, actually presented an empirical index where he showed that the terms of trade between the U.S., which he took as a measure of the primary commodities vis-a-vis the industrial goods, declined substantially over this same period. So it would be very unnatural for the U.S. economy to sustain high levels of employment and low levels of inflation, because they have a very low, a very good source of wage goods from outside the U.S. economy. And this brings me to my second concern, and about this new deal. So can one argue that a similar model, the U.S. can continue, even now that the world is more integrated in terms of global value chains and all, that a similar thing can be worked out today in the U.S. economy, that they exploit the world, or especially the poorer countries like Africa, and like last presentation we had about China and all, and also develop a similar relationship of a new deal where the U.S. economy transits into a very carbon-free economy, but the rest of the world might suffer because of this. And this is continuation of that, the second point. And this is important for the political narrative also, because, yeah, this would be my last one. This, because President Trump gives this narrative that, hey, India and China is doing well, they are burning carbon, coal, and why should the U.S. economy stop doing it? And at the same time, India and China says, hey, U.S. has been polluting the world through all the European countries are polluting. Why should the working class here stop using coal today? They should take up more responsibility. Whether that such these international coordinations are required today for the New Deal is something I thought of just bringing to your attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the first question, I think in principle, it's an extremely valid point where you can relax the supply constraints by just, you know, not because you actually are increasing productivity, but just because you're importing, and you can particularly transfer people out of agriculture if you can import. I don't think that that's really an important part of the story in the World War II U.S. I don't think the U.S. became a significant importer of food during that period, but I also think that it's a completely valid question that I should be able to answer with confidence. So this is helpful. It's something I should go back and I don't think that's the case. On the second point, I think actually one of the big advantages of the Green New Deal frame for decarbonization is precisely that it gets you out of this box of international conflict. That the argument, why should we have to make the sacrifices of decarbonizing when India and China are going on burning coal, is a persuasive one, as long as decarbonizing, as long as ceasing to use coal, is in fact experienced as a sacrifice. If doing large-scale public investment in order to rapidly transition to non-carbon energy sources is experienced by most people as leaving them better off, if it means more job security, higher incomes, a higher living standard today, then there's no conflict. There's no problem that saying why are we enjoying these benefits when people in India aren't? Well, that's never bothered Americans before. So I think and I also think that in general, a US economy that is growing, that is booming, that is experiencing very high demand, I think that's beneficial to poor countries of the world. I think most of the poor countries of the world do better in a setting in which the US is spending more. I think they obviously have an easier time exporting to the US. They have, you know, potentially an easier, I mean, for people who want to emigrate to the US, it's a much more favorable environment for that. I think that the US can be if there's a case where these technologies have increasing returns, so somebody makes the initial investment and then they're available around the world, the US taking the lead is actually beneficial. So I think that the notion of conflict is much more salient when you have this sort of scarcity framework where spending on decarbonization comes at the expense of other stuff. Then there's a big international coordination problem. How are the benefits are global? How do we distribute the cost fairly? If we don't actually think it's costly, then we don't have that international coordination problem anymore, not to the same extent. Yeah.
So thank you for the presentation. It was very interesting. But I'm going to develop this point a bit more, because it also came to my mind that the composition of demand during the war, I think actually it could have been fulfilled more through national manufacturing. Whereas now, if you invest in a green deal, the composition of demand is very different, and a lot of it actually comes from outside of the national borders. And so, have you thought about potential rebound effects and importing carbon as a result of having higher employment and more job opportunities?
Well, I think that's a valid question. I think the people who think in terms of this Green New Deal program are obviously have some notion of I think almost everybody in that sort of conversation has some notion of rebuilding, you know, U.S. domestic, I shouldn't say U.S., domestic industry, because the Green New Deal framing has also been adopted by a lot of people in Europe as well. I think they don't like it as much in Latin America, is my sense, but it's who did?
Really? Latin America, really? The Green New Deal is a...
Really? Some people I've talked to say people are,
American
people
American
find
American
me...
American
yes,
concept,
yes.
Global Green New Deal.
Yes, the Green New Deal. Okay, well, good. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've heard conflicting things from people about how acceptable that term is globally. But I'm glad that it is. So, yeah, I think there's generally a notion of rebuilding domestic industry. This is a program of industrial policy. I mean, that's a lot of when we talk about public investment or targeted, you know, public financing for investment. We're talking, obviously, about... So I do think... You know, I think...
But wouldn't that be more for primary energy sources or transport, etc., whereas clothes, food, electronics, that you would have to nationalize that as well if you want to prevent potential offsetting of what you're saving in carbon through energy infrastructure.
I know there are specific concerns, like, you know, lithium batteries, production is a problem. So there are specific, but I don't in general think that there's any good reason to think that all you can do is shift around the emissions. I think that if you replace, I mean, obviously there's some stuff like electricity, which is quite important, which there's no real international market in electricity. Maybe we should have one, but there isn't. If we're talking about, you know, buildings, which is a major source of emissions, that stuff is all a lot of the infrastructure, you know, is much. I think even in the cases where you're going to be buying more from the rest of the world, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think if we're helping other, I mean maybe this is my Keynesian perspective or whatever, but I think in general it is a more favorable environment for development in the rest of the world when the U.S. is importing more. I think that that helps both in terms of boosting demand and in terms of relaxing any sort of, you know, balance of payments constraint. So I guess I'm not convinced that there's any although there are specific sectors where I think the concern is valid, but I don't see a general argument why investment in decarbonization in the U.S. implies that higher emission or dirtier industries are going to end up operating somewhere else. I tend to think it's the other way around, that it makes it easier for other countries to follow this path. But I'd be interested in talking about it more. David.
You presented this very remarkable story of what happened in the U.S. economy during World War II as a story of a big boost in demand, a big boost in public investment, a big boost in public risk bearing. But isn't a key part of that story a shift from market determination to planning? That after all, they came up around the edges that the state was managing inter-enterprise flows in many cases, was directly buying a lot of the stuff that was being produced, was regulating prices. So the favorable results, I think, you have to take account not just of Keynesian type demand stimulation, but also the working of a planning system.
You know, when we were starting to work on this, we had this conversation because obviously there's a lot of lessons you could draw from World War II, and we thought about this stuff, and it's very interesting intellectually. I find it fascinating, you know, how this planning apparatus actually worked. But there is an effort to say what lessons can we pull out that are going to seem most relevant today, and I just felt like I it seems a lot harder to apply. Certainly, I don't just mean that it's not politically as easy to sell, because that shouldn't be a deterrent. But I just, it's harder, I think, to actually apply that to the current situation in some ways. I think I think that it's easier to make the case for a big public investment program than it is for a war planning board that actually directly allocates scarce inputs. I think it's harder, and it's not as obvious to me that it's as relevant. I mean, I do think, you know, the war effort was much bigger than the Green New Deal is going to be. By any the most ambitious programs for the Green New Deal don't come close, you know. You know, we're talking, you know, if with Bernie Sanders, you know, we're talking about 4% of GDP, not 40% of GDP. Maybe we need to think bigger than that, but there's still, so that's one. And two, you know, the war production was very narrowly focused. The decarbonization is going to be a broader, so it's harder for me to imagine that there's going to be like a handful of scarce inputs that really just have to be directly allocated in the way that steel and aluminum and rubber and oil were during the war and some other stuff, but I think it was mainly those four.
There's an analytical question. If the planning contributed a lot of the effectiveness of the program, then you have to take that into account and learn lessons. Unless you think,
well, I guess,
it was important in World War II, maybe it wouldn't be so important today.
Well, again, partly it's just a question of scale. Partly it's the fact that, again, the production was so focused on a relatively handful of industries that there really were just a few key, I mean, especially, you know, rubber early in the war was the absolute, you know, the critic, which is why they built this entire new synthetic rubber industry.
But they needed tires.
Yeah, yeah, and gaskets and all sorts of things, yeah. So I guess it's harder for me to make that analogy with the sort of Green New Deal program that I imagine today. But I take your point that, I mean, I think maybe the easier point maybe is that if we actually had inflation, we would want some form of price control rather than just tamping down demand. That's the sort of planning piece that I think, although at this point, obviously, that seems like a problem that's rather far away. No, we thought about this, but it just, in the end, it seemed harder to make the connection today. Maybe, you know, maybe we were wrong about that, but we did
transform the whole transportation system. You're going to, you know, make sure that there's an increase in electric charging stations along with the
right, but that's a different kind of planning.
You're going to retrofit all these buildings, commercial and residential. It's an interesting.
Right. It's planning for particular sectors or industries. The planning in the war was a because again, for these critical inputs, the government just stepped in and just replaced the market. And that sort of I find it harder. I'm not, maybe I lack imagination, but with that we made a conscious choice not to discuss that piece of it. Yeah, Carol. Well, some you know, some in the old fashioned people, well, it doesn't matter. Sometimes people don't like to call them two men, or I don't know. But
no, it's just two people. I think people should ask one question and not ask another one until anyone else has had a chance.
Okay, then you go ahead.
All right, thank you. Yeah, so I was also really intrigued by your history, and I want to throw a couple more standards in your making an analogy, even though I think there's a lot to be learned and a lot of the analogy works. But I want to get back to your first point about direct public investment. And I was wondering first, you know, you showed us how military spending went up and civilian consumption stayed pretty constant. Now, one big difference is that in the Green New Deal, actually, one part of consumption must decline, right? And that is high carbon product consumption. And there's also a producer side that would like to keep their share up there. So I was wondering if you could comment on that change. There's this sort of, you know, it's not a Pareto improvement for lack of a better shorthand. You know, everybody has more, but nobody needs to lose. But in the Green New Deal, a very important entrenched, powerful part of the economy needs to lose. So that seems to be a problem. Is Keynesian spending only good at blowing everything up, or can it also shrink something? That's my first point. And the second, slightly related one, is actually I fully agree with your larger role for direct public investment coming from the financing of innovation perspective, where we're seeing the same, and you know, remarkable suppression of the importance of this spending for, I would say, ideological reasons. But nevertheless, is there a difference between that war spending on possibly, I'm not so informed, possibly fairly well known and, you know, existing technologies versus in the Green New Deal, you know, a lot of the new products are not really well worked out. And you can challenge me on that. Yes, a lot of products are worked out now. But for instance, you mentioned battery storage. So is there an important component of spending on products and markets that don't actually exist yet? Is there an innovation component? But also, you know, I think you can cite the innovation literature as backup for saying that this is
yes,
an important component.
That's always the type of feedback you want. More things to cite. I think on the first question, I mean, during the war, some categories of consumption did fall. Again, there were no private autos. There were rubber. You know, gasoline was rationed. It's kind of interesting. Gasoline was actually rationed in order to conserve rubber. There was actually not a shortage of gasoline, but there was an extreme shortage of rubber. So to keep people from wearing out their tires too quickly, they rationed gasoline. There were no new cars, relatively little new housing. So relatively little, you know, consumption, you know, shifted away from consumer durables and towards non-durables. So some categories of consumption were curtailed, and obviously that will be, you know, perhaps obviously true in certain areas for the Green New Deal. But I think it's absolutely critical, and I think this is one of the big benefits of the Green New Deal frame, that it's not experienced as austerity. It's not experienced as having less. It's experienced as abundance. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who are actually kind of thinking about this. No, not necessarily economists, but journalists and other people in this space, you know, that we really have to have a language of like green, you know, green hedonism, green abundance, green, you know, this is I just saw this guy did this presentation with this great set of slides contrasting like individualized American consumption with various forms of collective consumption from elsewhere. So, you know, all these little backyards, which is a big public park, a little swimming pool in the backyard, a giant public swimming pool, and so on. You know, people in Soul Cycle, which is people dancing in a public square and something. Anyway, the point is that you have to talk about forms of consumption that are less carbon intensive, but that actually will be experienced by people. I think that it's just, I think it's possible. I think this is a lesson. And actually, people experience it as their lives were better than before. You never had it so good. And I think that can be the case, and I think that's really one of the biggest, maybe almost the biggest selling point of the whole Green New Deal approach. That it gets out of the box of presenting climate policy as being about sacrifice and austerity and having less. And, you know, that way you get the yellow vests and you get the whole kind of right-wing reaction to it, and it just doesn't work. And it's not necessary. So I think the Keynesian big spending approach makes it easier. I think it's easier to wean yourself of driving in a car when there's cheap electric cars with driving in a gas-powered car. If there's cheap electric cars with charging stations everywhere, that makes that transition easier. If there's great public transit and lots of new high-density housing built in city centers, it makes it easier to stop using a car at all. So I really think that I don't want to give even an inch on this. There's no need. On the second point, you know, I think, again, what's striking about the public investment during the war is precisely that the public investment was most concentrated in the most innovative industries where there was nothing. You know, uranium, okay, we don't necessarily like to talk, you know, the Manhattan Project is not, but this was an entirely new industry, an entirely new technology that actually involved a substantial amount of capital investment, which was all carried out by the federal government. Synthetic rubber, well, I guess I don't, I'll put it up. Synthetic rubber was was another one, which is a really interesting story, because, again, all the rubber plantations have been captured by Japan during the war, there's no rubber. So this new, you know, people had kind of experimented with synthetic rubber, you know, in the 20s, but there was no such thing as a synthetic rubber industry. It didn't exist. And this was, again, built completely from the ground up by the federal government. And then, actually, the federal government, actually, unlike most of this stuff, was all sold off at the end of the war. It's a really interesting debate where people on the left of the administration, like Walter Reuther, really were hoping we can turn these into worker cooperatives, we can turn them into something like the TVA, but they were all sold off. But synthetic rubber was not, because it was seen as of you know, key strategic importance. So the government continued actually operating those plants right up through the Korean War, and then sold them off at a profit. I mean, if you know, compared with the total cost of developing the industry. So, you know, and again, this is a completely new industry. This is a model for our, you know, our new energy storage technologies or whatever. In a sense, where the government's comparative advantage is if you have a clear technical goal that you want to achieve. You're not initially interested in, you know, is it profitable? You just have certain technical specifications that have to be met. It's actually, so, yeah.
So I have an observation and then a question. The observation is just that the labor elasticity, I think it's a really important point, and I'm very sympathetic to anti-crowding out argument. But there was, you know, even though women weren't the only important source of labor, they were a big one. And a lot of labor economists have talked about how that is basically has run out. I mean, we've already got most very high share of women in the paid workforce now. So it may mean that you need to include immigration policy as part of the Green New Deal, because there may be a labor constraint about that. That's the observation. And then the question is, you were at one point posing as alternatives. By the way, I think this is a really interesting project. I think the history here really matches a lot of what I know, so that's great that you're sort of spreading that around. The question is, you are posing as alternatives to public investment and the carbon pricing strategies. And it seems like one of the things that was so effective in World War II was the combination of intervening in the, you know, the price sector along with the public investment. So it's just, you know, why do you feel the need to, I know people do pose them as alternatives, but well, I think a price on carbon is an incredibly important part of this whole effort, and I'm wondering why you seem to be saying that if we have all this public investment, we don't need to worry about carbon pricing. Am I mishearing you?
Well, I mean, on the first point, just I think you're absolutely right on immigration, and we should be making the Green New Deal this. We should be talking about, you know, this is a major source. This is a major reason we don't have to worry about labor constraints, is that we can and should be admitting a lot more immigrants. And we actually don't have to admit more, because in periods of weak labor markets, the U.S. gets, you know, negative net immigration. So we can just, I completely agree with that, and should be mentioned in the paper, which it isn't right now. On the second point, you know, I was at a meeting in D.C., I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, with some very prominent people in kind of democratic policy world. And somebody, you know, said, you know, the only question about climate policy is whether a carbon tax is 80% of it or whether it's 100% of it or where it falls on that range. So if that's where the conversation is, then you sort of have to make the argument for public investment as opposed to a carbon price. If the starting point of where the conversation is that the carbon price is the whole story.
No.
Things have moved a lot in the last year and a half. It's true.
Now, if you look at the major
Yeah. Yeah, I think I think that it's probably good to have a carbon pricing component, because one way or another you're going to be limiting people's consumption of carbon intensive stuff. So you're going to be doing a carbon price sort of openly or cryptically, one way or the other. So I agree with you. I think I'm skeptical that it's a very big part of the solution. I agree with you that it doesn't have to be an either-or thing, though, and maybe that's something I should try to express differently. There's certainly nothing in this analysis that says a carbon price would be positively harmful. I certainly wouldn't try to defend that position. So, yeah.
Yeah. So the fundamental is not to push carbon price, but to push the question of scrapping the carbon economy. We have to throw out a lot of things that seem very useful. My internal combustion engine car seems very useful to me. I might also like an electric car. In fact, I have one of each. but I now have to be told, no, I'm sorry, the internal combustion car has to go. And I'm wondering, is there a sugar way as opposed to a carbon pricing way to scrap the things that we don't need? And by the way, this is a wonderful presentation. And is the paper available?
I should have distributed before this, but then I keep trying to revise it and improve it. But I will distribute it.
A spoonful of sugar with the scrapping of all these things that are available. You think about gasoline, it carries so damn much energy in a gallon of it. It just does amazing things. We'll take you 40, 3 miles on one drug of it.
I think the electric car is pretty much there in terms of a viable substitute if we have the charging stations. But obviously people already own the internal combustion cars, and you're going to... I saw somebody actually had some estimates of a cost for a global, cash for clunkers program. Just buy up. I mean, it's a substantial thing. I mean, it's comparable to, buying out the oil companies, but it's not at all beyond the limits of what's conceivable. You just buy up all those cars. And yeah, of course, that's probably better than just telling people they can't drive them anymore. But I don't think that there's any insuperable obstacle to... Yeah, okay.
I'm not sure if this is a commentary question, but I can go ahead there. I guess, again, I would draw you back to sort of the global perspective. Again, it depends on what's the goal of this particular project or the Green New Deal project in general. If the goal is to have a decarbonized U.S. economy, then I guess it's fine. But if the goal is to to stop climate change, I think it's important to think about it in a global dimension, regardless of value chains, etc. And it just depends on what's the goal for each project. But I think, especially because my personal view, and I think this should be the case, that the American economy needs to take leadership, given its role as the global hegemon of a global transition, given the resources, etc., that are associated. So that's just sort of a nudge. I really love this project. I think it's really amazing in a lot of different ways. As a Keynesian myself, I absolutely love everything that she said. But just sort of a nudge to sort of think about it globally. And this is where my question comes. Yes, as I was talking, it came to me. So when we're thinking about the terms of growth and thinking about development, right? And industrialization, I think, is the only path to development. Now, we already have a developed U.S. economy in the sense that it's highly industrialized, or it used to be highly industrialized, to the point where now the industrialization of the U.S. economy is global. Because in the sense that most of the industrial parts of it, of the production, are still owned by U.S. firms, just happening elsewhere. So it's still like a U.S. industrial economy, just sort of globally. And so then I wonder, why not think of it in that way, so that on the back of this, not only do you have compression of inequality within the U.S., but actually globally. When you think of industrial policy, instead of thinking of American industrial policy, in which I'm not even sure it's viable. I'm not sure whether we need further industrialization in the U.S. or whether we should. Again, I'm not sure. Perhaps you can always have more industrialization. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But there are very less industrialized places in the world where because of neoliberalism, global policy has just seized or deindustrialized. So given that, a lot of the industrial clusters all over the world are actually value chains which are owned by U.S. corporations, U.S. multinational corporations. Why not think of it in those terms? I know it's not your project, but like, I was just...
It's an interesting question. I mean, part of it, some of it is that it's definitely a major strand of the appeal of the Green New Deal is the notion of reindustrializing the United States, and particularly areas of the United States that have been most hit by deindustrialization. That's definitely part of the appeal of the project I have to admit I'm a little bit skeptical of U.S. policy to manage wages in the rest of the world. I'm not sure I really want the U.S. government playing that role.
But it's not so much managed wages. The wages are so low that it's not really a question of management at this point in the rest of the world.
Right. I guess my argument would be that the best thing you can do is for the U.S. The U.S. is a model that's been followed by a lot of the rest of the world, and the best thing you can do is set a different model. And again, that strong demand in the U.S., strong, high imports in the U.S., open up space in the rest of the world for countries to follow different strategies. I think historically there's a pretty clear pattern that when the center booms, the periphery has more space to pursue different and what a slowdown in the center is a crisis in the periphery. I think so. I think that it's not necessary to have this be an explicit global program in order for it to have global benefits, and I'm a little bit wary of proposing, because if we're talking about a U.S. political conversation, we're talking about the U.S. government. I think the U.S. government has really shown itself to be not trustworthy in managing the development or labor markets or really domestic life of other countries, and so I would be wary of.
I mean, it's not so much domestic life that I'm referring to. It's more about that the U.S. had its industrialization, Europe had its industrialization, but the structures have prevented industrialization in the rest of the world. So therefore, take this opportunity to create that space is what I'm saying. I actually do not want the U.S. government to be like, okay, you should do this.
Because there is this fear of green imperialism, saying, you have to stop burning coal and we're going to import. I think it's a real legitimate concern that the global problem of climate becomes a basis for reassertion of political dominance of the U.S. over the South. I think this is something I'd be interested in talking about more and thinking about how you can frame this in a more less U.S.-centric way, because I think that would be better.
Okay. Thank you, Josh, very much.
I didn't read it.
Yeah.
It's actually in the
Journal also. also war in macro economy. Anyway,
I need to run out. Oh. I always worry with economic historians.
On the whole, I thought I was nothing to object to on the historical side.
I'll send you a draft when I have one I feel ready to share.
Okay, great.
So, it looks like it's going to be a 2 o'clock dinner, which is fine. So it's Johnny's restaurant.
Reservation 6:15.
If you want,
okay, let me try to catch her. She's in some meeting, but we may both
join. I made a reservation before, so you would cause my reservation to be fully correct.
Oh, really? There's only two of you?
Okay.
That you marry the bigger table.
So what I can do is I have to head back now to get a message.
And let them know you're around.
Yeah, I might.